I don't have time to get into the details of the Arab response and the further into the development of the Palestinian identity. So I'm going to be very brief. As we know, in 1947, the UN partitioned Palestine, that part of the British Mandate. They partitioned it into two areas. They gave the Jews, who represented less than a third of the population, and who owned less than 5% of the land, the United Nations granted the Jews 55% of Palestine, and the rest was supposed to be immediately, you know, set up as an Arab state. The Arabs, of course, rejected this. I would object too if somebody from Spain came and said, well, you know, Evanston is going to be separated from Chicago, and Evanston is only for people with red hair. Why would I accept that? Right? Why would the Palestinians accept someone else who never lived there carving up their country? Right? So they rejected it. But they didn't reject it out of hand. What they proposed was a single democratic country. And it was the Zionists who rejected that. Okay? Now, the Zionists accepted the partition. They legally accepted it. That is, they signed it. But in practice, they immediately rejected it. Because the partition guaranteed the rights of the people who were living in both areas. But what the Jewish Agency did immediately upon accepting the partition is they began a wave of ethnic cleansing to kick out those who were living in the area given to them by the United Nations. So whereas they may have accepted the partition on paper, in reality they didn't accept it at all. I think it's important to look at, every colonialist project, has a manifest destiny, right? In the United States, right, in our colonies, we had a manifest destiny. It's been accomplished, okay? This was Zionism's, here's a statement by Moshe Dayan in 1973, shortly before Ben-Gurion's death. And some people think that this is really Ben-Gurion making a statement, his last public statement through his protege, Moshe Dayan, who writes, "Amongst ourselves, the Zionists, there can be no debate about the integrity of the land of Israel and about our ties and right to the whole of the land. When a Zionist speaks about the integrity of the land, this can only mean colonization by Jews of the land in its entirety. That is to say, from the viewpoint of Zionism, the real touchstone is not confined to the question as to whom this or that segment of the land belongs to politically, nor even to the abstract belief in the integrity of the land. Rather, the aim and touchstone of Zionism is the actual implementation of colonization by Jews of all the land of Israel." That is their manifest destiny. That is what their goal is. And they have never hidden it. They've absolutely never hidden this. So we have the incredible shrinking Palestine. Many of you have seen this map. From 1946 on the left, where Palestinians lived everywhere, to the partition in 1947, to the ethnic cleansing that kicked most of the Palestinians out of their homes, the vast, 80% of them, okay, 80% of the Palestinians were kicked out, and those who remained were immediately put under a military dictatorship for 17 years. So this process continues, and it's the Zionist colonization. It's the process of Zionist colonization, trying to achieve its manifest destiny. Now, what was the Palestinian reaction? The reaction by the indigenous population was predicted in a brilliant essay by the fascist leader of revisionist Zionist, Vladimir Jabotinsky, who in 1923, you know, there are people in this room, you know, it occurs to me often that, you know, the passions that are inflamed by this whole conflict, they're two groups. The passions are conditioned and informed by the universalism of Rabbi Hillel. And for others, their passions are conditioned and informed by the fascism of Rabbi Kahana. And I think we have some of those people in the room. As Vladimir Jabotinsky wrote, every reader has some general idea of the history of the colonization of other countries. I suggest that he recall all known instances. Let him go through the entire list and try to find a single instance of a country colonized with the consent of the natives. There is no such instance. The natives, whether they be civilized or uncivilized, have always put up a stubborn fight against the colonizers, whether they are civilized or uncivilized. Any native people, whether civilized or savage, view their country as their national home, of which they will be the complete masters. They will never voluntarily accept not only new masters, but also new co-owners or partners. This applies to the Arabs. He understood in 1923 that the indigenous Arab population was going to put up a fight, and they'd have. They've lost, for the most part, but they have not allowed Zionism to achieve its manifest destiny, because the Palestinians still exist, and now they exist as a self-defined, well-differentiated people. There was an Arab reaction to colonization because Zionism attached itself to British colonialism. The Arab national movements that were anti-imperialism necessarily were anti-Zionist. And because Zionism identified itself as Jewish, many of these anti-Zionist movements in the Arab countries became anti-Semitic, became anti-Jewish. So Jews were expelled from several countries. And they wanted to stay in others and were not expelled from others. For instance, Iraq. The Jews in Iraq, who had lived there for thousands, one of the oldest Jewish communities in the world, the Jews of Iraq did not want to leave. And so Israel in 1953 sent special agents to start blowing up synagogues in order to frighten the Jews in Baghdad into leaving. I want to finish very quickly. I've taken too long, and I see now that this lecture is too long. I need to pare it down. The British Empire has collapsed. Okay, there's a new empire, right? It's the U.S. The U.S. imperialism dominates the region. Okay? So Zionism was part and parcel of British imperialism, and now it is part and parcel of U.S. imperialism. Now, how did this happen? Before 1967, Israel was hardly on the radar in the United States. Didn't really care. After 1967, or the war, the Six-Day War in 1967, showed the U.S. ruling class that Israel was a formidable military power and could be very useful in maintaining its own interests and expanding its own interests in the Middle East. And therefore, they adopted Israel as part of the U.S. imperialism. And what this means is that now the U.S. and Israeli military industrial complexes are tightly intertwined. How can we be part of the historical process? I'm just going to go on to things we have to consider, okay? Any long-term solution must accommodate both national entities. Any solution must accept the fact that there are Israelis and that there are Palestinians. It has to be a regional solution and not just confined to Israel and Palestine, because those are, in a sense, artificial, and they are surrounded by Arab countries. And so any solution has to be regional. And any solution necessarily must confront the needs of U.S. imperialism. Because the U.S. imperialism wants conflict. And it's not really interested in a peaceful resolution and an accommodation of both Israeli and Palestinian nationalism. Necessary conditions for a just solution. There have to be equal rights for all. That means not only individual rights, but national rights. It must be based on international law, and it must include the right of Palestinians to return to their homeland or to be compensated to their satisfaction. And the Zionist colonialist project must be stopped. It must be superseded or transformed into another project. In other words, the Zionist manifest destiny has to be transformed into something else. It has to be stopped. Right? This is simply, I think, a fact. You know, without that, you do not have the necessary conditions for a lasting peace. I'm going to stop there. Thank you for letting me go over time. I really appreciate your attention.
Very much. And first of all, I would like to say thank you to everybody who stayed, whether or not you agreed. We will try to get to as many questions and a variety of questions as we can. If you have a question written down and you want to pass it up, that would be great. If you need something to write it on, let us know and we'll give you a card to write it on. But I have a couple of questions that have already come through, Mr. Finkel. The word apartheid is obviously a very loaded term. What specific rights are Arab and Palestinian people living in Israel denied that contribute to the concept of apartheid?
I'll give you a very simple example. You know, in the last few weeks, there have been major fires in Israel. They started near Druze communities. They could have been stopped immediately. But in the Druze communities and in Palestinian communities, there are no fire stations. Okay? That's just a very simple example of the dual nature of Israeli society. Okay? The dominant group, the Israeli Jews, write the laws. They decide where the money goes. They decide where the schools are built. They decide where people can live, where people can't live. The Israeli government just passed a law. If it had been passed in this country, you can be sure that Jews would be among the first people to demonstrate against it. The Israeli government passed a law that allows individual communities to deny other people the right to move into their communities. Now imagine if that happened. You know, that's Jim Crow. That ended in this country through a very vigorous civil rights movement in which, of course, many Jews were involved, right? The idea that a community can vote to keep another person out because of their religion, because of their ethnicity, because of their skin color, we would not tolerate that, okay? Well, in Israel, that's not only tolerated, that's the law, okay? It is illegal, it is now legal in Israel. Well, there are many examples. Funding for schools, for hospitals, for roads, for garbage collection, for sewage, right? All that money goes disproportionately to Jewish neighborhoods. And in the West Bank, okay, the system of apartheid is much more clear because you have roads that are exclusively for Jews only, right? You have institutions, you have settlements, you have all kinds of things that are reserved for Jews, for exclusive Jewish use, and Palestinians are simply not allowed by law.
You also mentioned the myth of Jewish national identity and the idea that there was not an idea of going back to Jerusalem, going back to Israel. And yet in the Passover liturgy, the Seder, we always say, next year in Jerusalem. And that's been a longstanding component of Jewish culture. So doesn't that demonstrate that there is, in fact, a longstanding desire to return to Jerusalem and to Israel?
No. No, as a matter of fact. That's a very pedestrian interpretation, and I don't believe that's an interpretation that the rabbis ever used, because what they were teaching was we're not supposed to go back until the Messiah comes. So what does that mean when we say next year in Jerusalem? It means several things. One is, it's an appeal to God. So would you send the Messiah already? Right? Because we can't go back until the Messiah arrives. Okay? So by saying next year in Jerusalem, and it's an appeal to God. So already, stop messing around. Send us the Messiah. Okay? Also, it is a metaphor. It is a metaphor for a better place, a higher state of spirituality. Right? A more just world. And so next year in Jerusalem means may next year we live in a more just world. May we be closer to God. May we be more righteous. But very few Jews ever considered it. You know, may next year we have the ability to go back and rebuild Zion and rebuild the temple. Because there were almost no major movements to do so. Right? Even Maimonides, when he left Spain, right? He didn't go and he made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. He didn't go back there to live, right?
Okay, a couple of questions on the concept that a democratic state in 1948 would have been safe for Jews, would have protected Jews, and also about Jews in Iraq being forced to leave. Or being encouraged to leave by, I believe you said, Jews who had blown up synagogues?
Israeli agents, yeah.
Okay. Just could you give some more evidence of that, and what makes you so sure that Jews would have been safe in 1948 if it had been a simple democratic state?
Well, in 1948, there was no chance of it being a simple democratic state because the historical processes, you know, had already been set in motion. In order to have created a single democratic state, you would have had to have historical processes that opposed that, and those were not that those Jews who opposed the creation of a Jewish state, their movement, the movement of Judah Magnus and Martin Buber and the anarchists, they were defeated. They were defeated by Zionism, by labor Zionism, by revisionist Zionism. And the Mufti, okay, the Mufti of Jerusalem. So it might have been possible to unify the two peoples. I mean, there had been. Times, for instance, there were trade unions in which there were Jews and Arabs in the same trade union protecting each other from the Irgun and the Haganah, but they were defeated by historical processes. Now, in Baghdad, in I believe it was 1943, there was a pogrom against Jews. It was organized by Nazi agents, and it is quite clear that most of the Jews were saved by their neighbors, and most of their neighbors did not attack them. This was in 1953. This was a living memory, and So Jews were, of course, very, very scared when their synagogue started to be blown up. But it has been revealed that they were not blown up by Nazis, they were not blown up by Iraqis, they were blown up by Israeli agents who wanted to entice the Jews in Baghdad to leave a country where they had lived for many centuries and in which they represented the middle class, the intelligentsia. They lived in middle-class homes. They did not want to leave. They finally allowed themselves to be airlifted out, where they were then dumped in the middle of the desert in tent cities, and from then on looked down upon by the rest of the Ashkenazi Jews in Israel.
You mentioned the other Israeli nationalist projects, the Bund, for example, and there are a couple of questions about descriptions of different Israeli nationalist projects and how they differed from Zionism.
This is a long subject, and I'm not a scholar on it, and so I don't want to pretend to be. But there were movements. First of all, as I said, there were many Jews most Jews were anti-Zionists. Most of the Jews who fought back against the Nazis were not Zionists. They were socialists and communists and anarchists who fought back against the Nazis. The Zionist Jews generally didn't. But there have been other movements, and I'm not a scholar on those, and I don't want to pretend to be one. But I'm sure there are books in this library that can teach you about the Jewish Bund and the movements within Russia to create an autonomous state in Russia.
Okay. Would there have been a state of Israel if there had not been a Holocaust?
Yes. Yeah, sure. I mean, the Holocaust had really nothing to do with it. The historical processes were in motion. The Zionists used the Holocaust. They appropriated the Holocaust through a very specific strategy. David Ben-Gurion turned Israel into the sole arbiter of Jewish justice, and through the Eichmann trial, created Israel as the sole judge and jury of the Holocaust. They invented myths about the Holocaust for their own purpose. They, at one and the same time, they elevated to national heroes the resistance fighters in the ghetto, right, in the Warsaw ghetto. But they hated the Holocaust survivors among them. They created. There's a fantastic book. It's not out here. You should look up Edith Zertel, who's written a fantastic book in which she analyzes how Israel utilized the real suffering of the Jewish people in order to advance the Zionist project. There was another part of that question.
Given the lack of U.S. political will to stop funding the Israeli military, how do you envision a future for this land of two peoples since the current situation is not sustainable? And is there any hope for a reconciliation process as occurred in South Africa?
Well, there's always hope for a reconciliation process, and there are Jews and there are Israelis and Palestinians who are involved in these processes. Groups of bereaved families on either side. There are organizations that bring fighters from both sides together. And in my view, the Israeli people and the Palestinian people want to live in peace. You know, this is generally the case. You know, people do not want to live, you know, in war. So the question is, why is there a permanent conflict? Right, and I suggest that the reason there is a permanent conflict is because it benefits the Israeli ruling class, and it also benefits the United States ruling class. So our task, as I mentioned before, our task is formidable, because any justice that is going to be able to accommodate both nationalities, and neither nationality is going to disappear, right? Any process has to confront U.S. imperialism, because U.S. imperialism is now the major driving force. If the Obama administration wanted to, they could change the situation in 1 minute with one single sentence. The Obama could say, from this point forward, the United States relationship with Israel will be predicated upon Israel's compliance with international law. Period. That would change everything. That single statement. Okay? But, of course, the Obama administration has no intention of ever saying that, for several reasons. One, the Obama administration does not want to invoke international law, right? Because the U.S. ruling class wants to put itself above international law. Right? And it doesn't do it because the U.S. economy benefits from a permanent conflict in Israel between Israelis and Palestinians. It's sad, but true.
When did Israel begin developing a nuclear bomb? And is it true or is it credible that the U.S. or a U.S. citizen may have aided Israel in developing the bomb?
No, I believe it was the French who aided Israel in 1956 in return for Israel starting a war against Egypt. France, in return, gave Israel the necessary nuclear technology.
Kind of a follow-up to the question about apartheid. Arab Israelis can vote, own businesses, go to school, and run for government office. So how is this discriminatory?
Arabs in Israel, in fact, Jews in Israel, cannot form a political party that has as its principle the Israeli Declaration of Independence, which states that Israel will be a state for all of its people. There is a law in Israel that prohibits any political party from advocating that Israel be a state of all its citizens. Right? Israel must be a Jewish state. It is a Jewish supremacist state by law. And you can have all the trappings of democracy you want. But if by law one group has supremacy over the other, then that democracy is meaningless.
There are a couple questions about other possibilities for resettling the Jewish people other than Israel. I know there was a project to settle in Uganda at one point. Just questions about would it have worked out better, or were there other reasonable options other than settling in Palestine?
Theodor Herzl, the father of political Zionism, went to his grave arguing that Uganda should be the new homeland for the Jewish people. Why? He said, basically, we are not going to be able to convince any Jews to come to this dirty, dusty backwater of a place. Let's go someplace that's green. Okay, let's go to Uganda. Well, we have absolutely, it'll be difficult to create any kind of myth that we have some kind of connection, material connection to the land, but that's where we should go. And Herzl went to his death, arguing that point.
But now,
excuse me, I'm answering the question. Now, Herzl also realized that no matter where the new Jewish state would be founded, there were already going to be people living there. Herzl understood that there was going to, that the Zionist colonial project, or the Zionist project of colonizing another land, would face an indigenous population, and that indigenous population would have to be moved. So, could it have been successful? You say, well, I don't know what that means. Could it have worked? What does that mean? Has it worked in Israel? to whose benefit? To whose detriment? Yeah, the United States, the manifest destiny has been accomplished, right? And the vast network of Indian nations has been reduced to selling trinkets, okay? And opening gambling houses, right? Now here's where a value judgment comes
in.
And so herein lies a value judgment, right? Do I think that's good that happened? And to me, no, it's not good. Okay? Now, the fact is that in Israel and Palestine, the Zionist colonial project is still going on, and we have an obligation to do something about it. At least in my moral code obligates me to do something about it.
Your last sentence, a different Israeli nationalist project.
Yeah.
Tell us your concept of a different one.
Well, I mean, I'll give it in a nutshell, okay? Zionism was quite self-consciously, the negation of Jewish history. Okay? The Jewish history was the history of diaspora, and Zionism was quite consciously the negation of that. Destroy the diaspora, have a single place. Okay? In my view, the development of an Israeli nationalist, an Israeli national identity, some people are calling it Hebrew, the Hebrew ethnicity, the Hebrew nationality, can be the negation of Zionism, right? So you could have a nationalist project which is not meant to colonize all of Palestine, but is to create a Hebrew nationality. It's already happening. It's not self-conscious. In fact, Israel, as far as I know, Israel is the only country that actually denies its own nationality, right? When you sign your identity card in Israel, you cannot say, I'm Israeli. You have to say, I'm Jewish or I'm Arab, right? You can't say, I'm Israeli. They deny their own, because they understand that if there were, in fact, an Israeli nationality, if they recognized it, right, that would be the undoing of Zionism. Doesn't make sense. How can I make it make sense to you, then? How can I explain myself? Zionism is more than simply is more than simply the state of Israel. Zionism is a process and a project of colonizing all of the land. Okay? Now, you can have a process that creates a Jewish, an Israeli identity, a Hebrew identity, people who speak Hebrew. Okay? And it doesn't necessarily, and they could abandon their project of colonizing all of the land. It's quite simple, it seems to me. Now, I mean, it's simple to state. It's not simple to do. I'm not saying this is all simple to do.
Okay, I think we have time for a few more. A couple people have asked what your educational and research background is and what sources you've used to research the statements you've made.
Professionally, I'm a computer programmer. I've been an independent computer programmer for 20 years. I have been a political activist since I was in high school, working against the Vietnam War. When I was in college, I organized a campus against South African apartheid. I have also been involved in Central American solidarity work and in labor solidarity work. This is one area of my political activity. The history that I have given you is informed by several sources. One, it's informed by the archaeology of Israel Finkelstein and Thomas L. Thompson. The history is informed by works by Marxists such as Abram Lyon. It is informed by research of what is collectively known as the new Israeli historians. That is, people like Simcha Flappin and Benny Morris and Avi Schleim and Ilan Pape, as well as many, you know, Palestinian historians as well. It's not like I'm, you know, making this stuff up. I've gathered it from reading some of the books that are here and many that are not here. And I recommend that people do the same. It's also informed by a fantastic book with a very bad English translation, but a fantastic book by Ilan Halevi, called A History of the Jews, Ancient and Modern. Ilan Halevi, for 25 years, has been the PLO representative to Europe in Paris. He's a Jewish Palestinian.
What is the basis for your statement that most American Jews are not Zionists?
Several years ago, there was a study by, I believe, Lenny Brenner, who looked at polling data, and his conclusion was that far less than 20% of American Jews considered themselves to be Zionist. Now, does this mean that Jews in this country don't have an affinity for Israel? Of course not. But that's different than being a Zionist, right? It's different than being a Zionist. I have an affinity for Israel. I have family living there. I have friends living there, okay? That doesn't make me a Zionist, right? And it's not unnatural or criminal or anything to have an affinity for, you know, for people where your, you know, where your family lives and all that, right? So, but according to Lenny Brenner, far less than 20% of Jews in this country identify themselves as Zionist. No. Now, that Zionism, there are many types of Zionism. As I mentioned, there is Christian Zionism. Zionism is, look, there's religious Zionism. Labor Zionism. There's a book by Sieb Sternhell called The Founding Myths of Israel. I recommend it highly, in which he examines the origins of labor Zionism. And he sees the origin, he identifies the origin of labor Zionism in what he calls nationalist socialism. He cannot bring himself to call it national socialism because that would mean fascism. So he calls it nationalist socialism. Specifically, labor Zionism began as a reaction against the liberalism of the Enlightenment and also against the radical democratic socialism of Marx, whereas Marx sought to mobilize human labor to liberate itself, labor Zionism sought to mobilize human labor to build and glorify a state, okay? Just as the fascists in Germany did, okay? This was what labor Zionism was all about. It was to mobilize Jewish labor to build a state, a Jewish state, to conquer, and this is their words, to conquer Arab labor. And what that meant was to displace Arab labor with Jewish labor. That is what labor Zionism was all about. That was their goal. And it remains their goal to conquer Arab labor, to replace Arab labor with Jewish labor. And this is what they have done quite successfully. But I highly recommend Sieb Sternhell. Sieb Sternhell is a professor at Hebrew University. I forget exactly what university in Israel he is. You know, he works, but he's a scholar. He's a scholar of these subjects. And his book is called The Founding Myths of Israel. Brilliant book.
And we have it in the collection.
Great.
What map do you believe represents what Zionists believe to be part of Israel, to be included in Israel?
There are some Zionists who feel that the partition is enough, the map of the partition. There are some people who believe in that the Jewish state should extend throughout all of the mythical land of Israel and Judah, and you know all the way east of the Jordan to the Euphrates River. Fortunately, I think, to my point of view, fortunately, there you know these are very few in number, and most Israelis would laugh at that idea. But there are Zionists who want the whole thing, and there are Zionists who there are in fact Zionists who want no state at all. Okay, there are Zionists who are in fact, until I believe 1943, the World Zionist Organization had as its goal the creation of a Jewish homeland, not a Jewish state, and this is what caused Jabotinsky to split and form his own right-wing organization, because he was opposed to the idea of simply creating a Jewish homeland. He wanted a Jewish state. And I believe it was 1943 that he came back in because the World Zionist Organization changed its goal, and it was to create a Jewish state. But there were many Zionists who did not want a state. They wanted a homeland.
Which is what?
Well, a homeland... Look, As far as I'm concerned, Chicago is my homeland. Chicago is one of the Jewish homelands, right? It is. It just is. There are many Jews living in Chicago, right? Right? Europe, right? Germany. You know, there are many Jews who are leaving Israel and rebuilding a community in Berlin, right? That is their historic homeland, right? It's not Palestine. It's Europe. That's where Ashkenazi Jews created themselves, right? We created ourselves not in Palestine. We created ourselves in Eastern Europe. This is where this is our homeland. Now, there were some people who said, no, we need our own homeland, and we obviously cannot do it in Europe because we're being kicked out of Europe. So instead of fighting back against anti-Semitism, they embraced anti-Semitism and used it as a motivation to get Jews out.
Why hasn't the divestment movement and pro-Palestinian activity caught on the way the movement against South Africa and apartheid did in the 1980s?
In fact, it's catching on much faster. This is the actual fact. It took years and years and years and years of work before the anti-apartheid divestment movement got off the ground, right? It's happening very rapidly in this country and around the world to put pressure, and this is completely nonviolent, you know, pressure on the Israeli state to change its behavior. It's happening very rapidly, much more rapidly than it did with South African apartheid. And by the way, it's also much more important, and let me tell you why. In South Africa, South African apartheid had a different motive than Israeli apartheid. South African apartheid was put in place in order to ensure a cheap supply of black labor, super exploited labor. Okay, now what did this mean? It wasn't the divestment movement that overthrew apartheid, right? It was the working class. It was the working class in South Africa that overthrew apartheid, that transformed society. And they had working class institutions because they had power, their labor power, right? What has Israel done? Israel has removed almost all Palestinian labor, right? Israel employs almost no Palestinian labor anymore. So the Palestinians cannot use their working class institutions to challenge Israeli apartheid. Instead, Israel has imported labor from places like Thailand and Romania, and these are super exploited, right? With no mechanism of organizing, right? So Israeli apartheid is not designed to ensure a cheap supply of labor. Israeli apartheid is there to support the process of colonization, that is, to gain as much land with as few Arabs and to concentrate the Arabs elsewhere. So it's still apartheid, but the motive force is different. And that means that whereas South African apartheid could be attacked from within, and it was defeated from within, Israeli apartheid, it's up to us. It has to be attacked from without as well as within. But see, in South Africa, the black workers were agents of their own liberation. They could be, right? But as I said, in my view, in Palestine, the Palestinians are unable to be agents of their own liberation. That's where we come in.
You've mentioned how fast the divestment movement is growing, and someone asked, how fast is Jewish Voice for Peace growing?
I don't have the numbers, but let me tell you, we are growing very quickly. We have tens of thousands, if not 100,000 people on our email list. We see major divisions happening within the Jewish community, particularly among divisions between the old and the young. Young Jews are no longer being raised with the Holocaust paradigm as their parents were. It's a very powerful paradigm, but young Jews are growing up with a different paradigm and are growing up with a paradigm that emphasizes justice. So, for instance, at the you may know about this group J Street, which is more or less a lobbying organization. At their main conference several months ago, the young Jews from New York refused to use the J Street motto. The J Street motto is pro-Israel, pro-peace. And the young Jewish representatives from New York said, no, we're not going to say we're pro-Israel, pro-peace. We're going to say we're pro-justice. So there is a split in the Jewish community. There are rabbis who are finally, you know, beginning to speak out. And how quickly this is going to happen, it's hard to say. I will predict, however, that in the past, we've seen an uptick in the growth of Jewish anti-occupation groups every time there is a major Israeli atrocity. So the war in Lebanon, the massacre of Gaza, right? And we can be sure that Israel will commit another atrocity, and there will be more Jews who will say it's time to become part of an organization. It doesn't have to be Jewish Voice for Peace. It can be, you know, American Friends Service Committee. It can be the International Solidarity Movement. It can be any number, you know, Christian Peacemaker Team. You know, everybody's important.
You described Israel as a colonial settler project. The U.S. itself is a colonial settler project. How do you think this relates to persistent U.S. sympathy for Israel?
I don't think it relates at all, actually. Because the U.S. colonial project ended a long time ago, okay? The Iroquois, on orders from General Washington, you know, the Iroquois were exterminated. You know, we're beyond that. And I don't think that the American ruling class, which is the group that's making policy, they don't care that, oh, we were once a colonial state with our own manifest destiny. I don't think they think in those terms. They think in terms of how do we increase the rate of return on our investment. That's what they're interested in. How do we maximize the rate of return on our investment? And that means we need to control petrodollars. It means we have to have a large military because there are much higher rates of profit in the military sectors. And if you have a military, that means you need to deplete your inventory and replenish your inventory, and that's good for business. And I think that the powers that be in this country think in those terms and don't think in terms of, oh well, we used to be a colonial empire, colonialist country, you know, so we have to support others. Don't think they think in those terms.
Israel plays a role for the United States Empire in attacking Iraqi nuclear power plants, supplying military aid to South Africa, et cetera, et cetera. Could you comment on that relationship?
The United States has used Israel as an arms manufacturer and two, as an arms supplier to places around the world where the United States did not want to become directly involved with arms sales. This is seen in Central America in particular, and in the fact that the Israeli army is training U.S. forces in, you know, how to surround villages in Afghanistan and Iraq and how to deal with resistance, and the whole thing has become intertwined. And as I tried to point out before, the Israeli military sector and high-tech sector that supports that is what has kept Israel relatively buoyant in a world economy that's, you know, been going down the toilet. But the Israeli economy is fairly robust, and it's mainly because it is to a large extent it's because it's based on these military and as I say, military goods have to be. The inventories have to be depleted. I mean, why do you think that at the end of the war on Lebanon several years ago, you know, within within hours of the declared ceasefire, Israel emptied almost its entire inventory of cluster bombs on southern Lebanon. Right? I think they did it because they wanted to get rid of this old inventory. Right? Now we can make more money, we can obtain more. We have to get rid. If you got all these ammunition, you gotta use them. Right? I think that's part of what explains what goes on in Gaza. In my mind, I think that Gaza is used as a laboratory, you know, testing new weapons, and being a place to dump weapons. You know, it's really, you know, I know people will think that's very, you know, cynical of me to say such things, but I believe it.
You spent almost 2 hours here. First of all, before I thank Mr. Finkel, I just really want to thank the audience. For the most part, you've been extremely respectful. You've asked a lot of really wonderful questions. So thank you very much.
Women denied the Holocaust and said that this was the Zionist project.
No, but look, I think this is an important question, okay? And I will be happy to answer it, okay? The question is, do I deny the Holocaust, or was the Holocaust a Zionist project? And now, if you would be so kind as to listen to my answer, instead of turning your back on me and walking out.
I listen to you for enough, and I never listen for schmuck like you for a long time.
Пожалуйста, please. I take objection to people who use the real suffering of my ancestors, my family, family of my friends, to justify the imposition of an unjust war and colonization on another people.
Okay.
It's not that I deny the Holocaust. The Holocaust is a historic fact. I deny those people who would use that to inflict pain and suffering upon other people. It's just that simple.
So once again, thank most of you in the audience for being respectful. And thank you very much to Mr. Finkel for what I think was an extremely enlightening and interesting presentation, and also to Neighbors for Peace for helping us to put this project together. So thank you all both very much.